Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take a stack of sources and extract the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight.
Today, we are taking a deep dive into an actor whose signature look, that all-black suit, the distinctive voice, that rugged but thoughtful face, it really defined the television Western for a whole generation.
But the man behind the persona, Richard Boone, lived a life that was far more complex, contradictory, and honestly, more cosmopolitan than any of those dusty roads he traveled on screen.
We're really examining the legend of Richard Boone, an actor known for over 50 films, but I mean, let's be honest, he is eternally recognized as Paladin.
Right.
The well-read, card-carrying gunfighter from Have Gun Will Travel. And if you only know him as the tough guy who lived in a San Francisco hotel, collected rare books, and quoted philosophy right before a gunfight, you're really only scratching the surface.
That dual identity is exactly why this deep dive is so necessary. Our mission today is to go way beyond the Paladin persona and explore the full scope of his achievements. We're peeling back the layers on, well, a true Renaissance man, a World War II combat veteran who was also a serious New York-trained method actor.
And a restless college dropout, a key voice actor in major animated fantasies, and in his later years, an unexpected cultural ambassador for the state of Florida. He even influenced major shifts in television production. It's a huge story.
It really is. The initial snapshot of Boone is just fascinating because of all these internal contradictions.
Right. How does a man with that kind of serious, methodical training from the prestigious Actors Studio, a place steeped in Stanislavski technique, how does he become the ultimate icon of the cerebral frontiersman?
Yeah, and how does a former tail gunner, someone who saw active combat in the Pacific, transition to playing figures like Pontius Pilate and Abraham Lincoln?
We're tracing how those very non-Western experiences shaped the character that ultimately made him immortal. This is a story about how deep preparation leads to versatile and, you know, really enduring performance.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start at the beginning in section one and look at the complex foundation of his early life and training. What's immediately striking is that this quintessential Western star, Richard Boone, was born right in the cradle of the film industry.
He was. Richard Allen Boone, born in Los Angeles, California, June 18, 1917. He was the middle child, and his father, Kirk E. Boone, was a corporate lawyer.
So that already sets him apart. This isn't the typical narrative of an actor climbing out of poverty or, you know, the backwoods. He came from a well-established white-collar family in a major city.
And the irony here is just fantastic. The last name Boone is just so loaded with American folklore and frontier history. And for him, it wasn't just a name. He was actually connected to it.
Really? How so?
Well, the sources confirm this, and it's incredible. Boone was a great-great-great-great-great-grandson of Squire Boone.
Wait, Squire Boone?
Uh-huh.
As in the brother of Daniel Boone?
The very same. The brother of the most famous American frontiersman.
No way. So the actor who would later define the image of the sophisticated American frontiersman was literally born into lineage of the most famous frontiersman in American history.
You can't make it up. It's an unbelievable piece of historical casting. He was born into the very mythos he would later embody on screen.
That gives a whole new context to his ability to play Paladin, who was basically a modern intellectual version of that Daniel Boone archetype.
It's as if the historical frontier gave way to the intellectual frontier right in his own bloodline.
And there's another layer of cultural richness in his family background that really complicates that image of the, you know, monolithic American cowboy.
Yes. His mother, Cecile née Beckerman, was Jewish, the daughter of immigrants from Russia.
So his Los Angeles upbringing would have been culturally diverse, far more worldly than the image of a simple Western star might suggest?
Absolutely. His household would have had serious professional expectations from his father's side, and then the immigrant experience and deep cultural traditions from his mother's side.
Now, before he committed to acting, his education and his pre-war life seemed marked by a kind of restlessness, like he was searching for where he belonged. He graduated from Hoover High School in Glendale, California, and then at first, he followed a pretty conventional path.
He did. He went to Stanford University, was part of the Theta Chi fraternity, which suggests, you know, maybe he was trying to follow that path of his corporate lawyer father.
But that didn't last long.
Not at all. The restlessness won out. He dropped out before graduating. And I think this is a key insight into Boone's character. He was not afraid to walk away from the expected stable route if it wasn't feeding his curiosity.
And instead of finishing his degree, he decided to embrace a series of highly physical, diverse, and demanding jobs. This is what the sources call his pre-acting hustle, and it's so critical for understanding the authenticity he brought to his roles later on.
We're talking about an oil rigger, a bartender, a painter, and even a writer.
Think about that variety. Oil rigging is brute strength and resilience. Bartending, that's observation, quick wit, knowing human nature.
And painting, that's physical labor but with an aesthetic sense. And writing, of course, is all deep introspection and structured thought.
Do the sources give us any clue what kind of writing he did? Or how that intellectual side worked with the physical demands of being an oil rigger?
The specific content isn't detailed, but just the act of being a writer is significant. It shows this simultaneous commitment to both the intellectual and the physical, the internal and the external.
That ability to switch gears, I mean, to spend the morning on a rig and the evening composing prose, that perfectly mirrors Paladin.
Exactly. Who could go from reading poetry to a gunfight in a heartbeat? These varied experiences meant that when he finally started acting, he wasn't just playing a character, he was drawing on lived experience from almost every economic and social level.
That incredible variety, it speaks volumes about his restless curiosity. But then everything was put on hold when World War II erupted. This transition is maybe the single most important inflection point in shaping the man who would become Paladin.
Absolutely. His World War II service from 1941 to 1945 was foundational. Boone joined the United States Navy in 1941. He served on 3 different ships in the Pacific Theater, and he saw serious combat.
This was not a safe stateside assignment. He was in the thick of it.
And the role he held was incredibly dangerous. It required extreme discipline and precision.
What was his rank?
He was highly skilled, achieved the rank of Petty Officer First Class. His combat role was aviation ordnanceman, air crewman, and, crucially, a tail gunner on Grumman TBF Avenger torpedo bombers.
A tail gunner. That is one of the most terrifying, isolated, high-stakes positions in aerial combat. You're the last line of defense, sitting alone, facing the enemy.
The experience of surviving that pressure cooker, the intensity, the focus, the discipline, you just can't overstate it. It provides this immediate depth and credibility to every tough guy role he ever played.
So when Richard Boone stood his ground as Paladin or Heck Ramsey, the audience instinctively felt the genuine authority of a man who had faced down mortality. He wasn't pretending to be a man of action.
He demonstrably was one.
And the sources suggest that when he returned, all that discipline and emotional intensity he gained from combat had to be channeled somewhere. And that's exactly what happened when he used the GI Bill to go to the stage.
The shift was deliberate and it was decisive. While he had a slight introduction to theater earlier at the San Diego Army and Navy Academy, it was post-war that he made the serious commitment.
He used the GI Bill to study acting at the prestigious Actor Studio in New York.
And here is where the intellectual and the visceral finally merge. Studying at the Actor Studio meant he was steeped in method acting, that deep, internal, psychological approach to character.
Indeed. The source material describes his approach as serious and methodical. The method is all about connecting the character's internal life to the actor's emotional reality.
And for Boone, this meant he could take the trauma and discipline of his WWII service, the observation skills from his manual labor, and just channel them into a deeply studied character. He wasn't interested in superficial gestures. He wanted to understand the psychological weight behind the actions.
This methodical training is the key to understanding why Paladin wasn't just some stock cowboy hero. The method lets you play contradiction authentically.
Right. It explains why Paladin could be both tender and lethal, philosophical and rugged.
That's the crucial insight. His training meant that when he put on the black suit and hat, he wasn't just playing a Western cliche. He was portraying a complex, educated man struggling to apply a moral code in a savage environment.
And this methodical approach is the foundation for everything that follows, which leads us right into section 2, covering his serious Broadway beginnings, his early film career, and his unexpected path to Hollywood.
Section 2 starts with those Broadway beginnings, confirming that before any of the television fame, Boone was established as a serious theatrical actor in New York City.
His Broadway debut was a colossal moment. 1947 in Medea, starring theatrical titans Judith Anderson and John Gielgud.
Wow.
This wasn't some small off-Broadway production. This was a major, high-profile drama that ran for 214 performances.
So for a post-war actor on the GI Bill, landing a role in Medea right out of training, that says a lot about his immediate talent and gravitas.
And he quickly followed that up. He was in Macbeth in 1948 and The Man in 1950, which was directed by the influential Martin Ritt.
So we're talking heavy, demanding, prestigious roles. Shakespeare, Greek tragedy, intense drama. This is a world away from the fast-paced, often disposable nature of early television.
And it's cemented his reputation in the professional theater community. It really speaks volumes about his artistic priorities at the time. He was committed to the craft, the stage, and challenging material.
Though he was doing TV even back then, wasn't he?
He was. He was in a short-lived TV series based on the play The Front Page from 1949 to 1950, and he worked on early anthology series like Actors Studio and Suspense. He was constantly honing his ability to shift focus, moving from a long Broadway run to the rapid pace of live television drama.
But the anecdote that defines his arrival in Hollywood is just fantastic because it has nothing to do with the screen test, his method training, or his physical presence.
It was all about his voice.
Tell us that story.
This is one of the most celebrated moments in his history. Elia Kazan, who had already directed Boone, employed him for a simple favor, to feed lines to an actress who was auditioning for a screen test directed by Lewis Milestone.
So Milestone is supposed to be watching the actress?
Entirely, trying to gauge her screen potential. But the sources say that Milestone was completely unimpressed by the actress.
But he couldn't ignore the man reading the cues off camera?
Precisely. Milestone was just captivated by Boone's distinctive vocal quality, the sheer power and gravelly texture of that voice. This auditory first impression was so strong that Milestone summoned Boone to Hollywood sight unseen for a meeting.
And that led directly to a major 7-year contract with 20th Century Fox in 1950.
All from his voice.
That's a career built on serendipity and an incredibly powerful instrument. Imagine that. A serious New York method actor gets his big break just by having a voice so arresting it upstages the lead actress on camera.
It's a remarkable detail. His voice carried the weight of his experience, the combat, the labor, the stage training. Once he signed with Fox, his early film career immediately reflected his rugged history.
Right, dominated by military roles. His screen debut was as a Marine officer in Milestone's Halls of Montezuma in 1951.
The same director who hired him for his voice.
So Fox immediately capitalized on that credibility, casting him in uniform repeatedly in films like Call Me Mister and The Desert Fox.
He moved quickly into more substantial parts too, showing his versatility. He was in Red Skies of Montana and Kangaroo in 1952. In Kangaroo, also directed by Milestone, his role was actually expanded from the original script because of how commanding he was on screen.
He was working with major figures constantly, including reuniting with Elia Kazan for Man on a Tightrope in 1953.
But maybe the most enduring, if brief, early movie role was in a massive technological breakthrough that year.
Right. He was cast as Pontius Pilate in The Robe in 1953.
And this film is historically significant because it was the first feature film ever shot in CinemaScope.
Wow.
So even his supporting parts were historically significant. He was there at the very beginning of widescreen cinema. And he followed that up by appearing in the second CinemaScope film, Beneath the 12-Mile Reef.
He was very consistent.
It's important to pause here and note that despite the success and the stability of a 7-year studio contract, Boone wasn't content. The sources highlight that he eventually broke his contract and left Fox.
And this reinforces that theme of independence we saw when he dropped out of Stanford. Boone was willing to trade guaranteed stability for artistic control or more fulfilling roles.
A studio contract would have chafed the serious, methodical actor trained at the Actor's Studio.
Absolutely. He chose mobility over stagnation.
That independence led him directly to his television breakthrough with Medic. And this is where his prior military roles intersect with a key professional relationship he forged during Halls of Montezuma with Jack Webb.
That friendship was critical. Jack Webb, the producer and star of Dragnet, was a major power player in 50s television. He clearly valued Boone's intense focus.
So not only did Boone appear in the 1954 film version of Dragnet, but Webb chose him as the lead for his new medical drama for NBC.
And that show was Medic. Boone starred as Dr. Conrad Steiner from 1954 to 1956. This put Boone's authoritative, focused intensity into American living rooms on a weekly basis, but in a totally different context.
Medic was a really important show for its time, wasn't it? It treated medical procedure with a seriousness and realism that was rarely seen before.
It capitalized on Boone's innate gravitas. And this role didn't just give him exposure, it earned him his first major industry accolade, an Emmy nomination for Best Actor in 1955. He was recognized as a serious, dramatic actor in the new medium.
And even while starring in a demanding weekly drama like Medic, he maintained this incredible output in film and guest spots. This is where he really began to cut his teeth in the Western genre, before Paladin even existed.
Oh yeah. He appeared in films like 10 Wanted Men and Man Without a Star with Kirk Douglas. These roles were often complex, sometimes antagonistic, showing his facility with those tough, morally ambiguous characters that thrive in Westerns.
His most critically regarded pre-Paladin role was in The Tall T in 1957, right? As the villain Frank Usher.
Alongside Randolph Scott, he proved he could handle the Western setting while maintaining that serious theatrical edge.
And his versatility was on full display in those anthology guest spots. He wasn't just doing Westerns or military parts.
Far from it. He guest starred on General Electric Theater, and maybe most surprisingly, he tackled literary romance. He starred as Heathcliff in an adaptation of Wuthering Heights on Matinee Theater.
Heathcliff.
He also played the infamous outlaw John Wesley Hardin on Studio One in Hollywood. So this broad exposure, from intense theatrical training to medical drama to classic literature, was the perfect high-octane crucible that forged the unique character of Paladin.
And all of those elements converge in Section 3, which covers the defining icon of his career. Paladin in a Have-Gun Will Travel.
And the origin story of this show, I mean, it's one of those fantastic, almost unbelievable Hollywood twists. Here's where it gets really interesting. The role of Paladin, the sophisticated gun for hire, was never originally written or intended for Richard Boone.
Who was it for?
It was first offered to the legendary Western star, Randolph Scott. Scott, however, decided to turn the role down.
But the critical connection is that Scott, a veteran of the genre, handed the script directly to Boone. This happened while the two of them were actually filming 10 Wanted Men together.
That moment is so revealing. It shows that by 1957, Boone's reputation for bringing intellectual depth and credibility to his roles was so high that a major star recognized him as the perfect, unconventional fit for a role that transcended the standard Western template.
Scott recognized that Paladin needed more than a stoic face. He needed an actor who could play intelligence.
And Boone delivered. From 1957 to 1963, he starred in the role. The series quickly became a massive hit, running for 6 seasons, 225 episodes. It secured Boone's place in the cultural firmament.
He went from a critically acclaimed New York actor to a national icon.
And the Paladin persona was a genuine anomaly in the Western genre. The show was set in the late 19th century West, but Paladin lived a life of luxury and culture in San Francisco's Hotel Carlton.
He wore black, carried a custom engraved Colt revolver, and his calling card was a knight chess piece. But most importantly, he solved most problems with his brain before resorting to the gun.
That dualism, the highly educated man who could recite Shakespeare and debate philosophy, yet was lethally skilled with a weapon, was perfectly tailor-made for Boone's background.
It leveraged everything he had learned, the physicality of the oil rigger, the discipline of the tail gunner, and the theatrical depth of the method actor.
Right. He could credibly deliver lines about Greek philosophy, engage in intellectual banter, and then in the very next moment display the cold, contained intensity of a man capable of lethal violence.
His methodical training allowed him to synthesize the cerebral and the savage without making the character seem ridiculous or pretentious.
The show was smart and Boone's performance was complex, and the industry recognized this, earning Boone Emmy nominations for the role in 1959 and 1960.
What's remarkable to me is that even during the absolute peak of his fame as Paladin, Boone wasn't content to just collect a paycheck. He kept returning to the stage.
Almost as if he needed to remind himself and the audience that his core identity was as a serious Broadway actor. In 1959, right in the middle of the show's run, he took a diversion back to Broadway to star as Abraham Lincoln in The Rivalry.
It ran for 81 performances. This level of commitment to live, demanding theater while starring in one of the highest rated shows on television is just extraordinary.
Most actors would use that hiatus time to vacation. Boone used it to tackle American history.
He also managed to weave in other high-profile cameos during this period, like playing General Sam Houston in John Wayne's epic, The Alamo, in 1960. He clearly sought out roles that required significant historical or dramatic weight.
And we get a wonderful loop back to his earliest television work. He was an occasional guest panelist on the popular quiz show, What's My Line? And on that show, he would openly reminisce with host John Charles Daly about their days working together on that short-lived 1949 TV series, The Front Page.
These connections show how his serious New York phase informed his Hollywood stardom. He never lost touch with his roots in serious drama.
Not at all.
After Have Gun Will Travel wrapped in 1963, Boone immediately launched an ambitious new project, The Richard Boone Show. It shows he was not interested in just replicating the Paladin success.
This was Boone's attempt to truly bring the ensemble spirit and diversity of the Broadway stage to weekly television. His own anthology series ran from 1963 to 1964.
The structure was unique, wasn't it? It used a recurring company of actors.
A repertory company, yes. They would take on entirely different roles and dramatic styles week after week. It was a true effort to push the boundaries of television narrative, rejecting the conventional wisdom of weekly character consistency.
It sounds like a difficult concept for mainstream network television in the 60s to sustain. Audiences gravitate toward familiarity.
It was difficult, which is probably why it was short-lived, but it was incredibly respected by the industry. The Richard Boone Show won a Golden Globe for Best Show in 1964, and Boone earned his fourth Emmy nomination that year.
So it was a critical success.
It cemented his status as an actor-producer who valued complexity, range, and innovation over chasing ratings or predictable formats.
It demonstrates that his core identity was as an actor who appreciated the craft of transformation, not just a star who settled for a typecast role. And that artistic ambition immediately leads us into Section 4, where Boone begins moving away from the conventional Hollywood center, influencing the television landscape in entirely unexpected ways.
Following the cancellation of his anthology show, Boone made a massive geographical and professional shift. In 1964, he and his family relocated thousands of miles away to Honolulu, Hawaii.
This wasn't a casual move. He made a clear statement reflecting his frustration with the TV industry at the time. The sources quote him saying, "It's harder and harder to do your best work on TV."
He was seeking an environment where the pressures of Whitley network production were far away, allowing him to focus on quality.
You might think of it as a tactical retreat, but that retreat led to one of the most significant and often overlooked aha moments in television history.
It's incredible. Boone played a direct catalytic role in the genesis of one of the longest-running, most successful crime dramas ever, Hawaii Five-0.
Okay, this truly deserves a deep dive. This is a story of local advocacy fundamentally changing global television geography.
It is. The show's producer, Leonard Freeman, was developing Hawaii Five-0, but faced the standard dilemma of production logistics and cost. Freeman initially planned to film the show using Hawaii for visually stunning establishing shots.
The aerial views, the beautiful beaches.
Exactly. But he intended to do the bulk of the interior and principal production work back in Southern California. This was a common money-saving practice at the time.
But Boone, living there and seeing the potential, he stepped in as a passionate advocate for the islands.
He convinced Freeman otherwise. Boone argued vigorously that not only could the islands provide all the necessary infrastructure and crew support, but that filming exclusively in Hawaii would provide an unparalleled level of authenticity and atmosphere that you just couldn't fake on a studio lot.
He was essentially arguing that the setting was a character itself.
It was. And his advocacy was the key factor in establishing Hawaii as a major, sustainable television production hub, setting a precedent that continues to this day.
And the producer, Leonard Freeman, was so impressed by Boone's enthusiasm and dedication to the state that he made him an extraordinary offer.
Freeman offered Boone the lead role of Detective Steve McGarrett.
And Boone turned it down. Why? Why turn down the lead role in a massive series that he personally helped launch and champion?
It speaks to his selectivity and maybe a lingering reluctance to be locked into another six-year network commitment after his past experiences. He had retired to Hawaii to escape that kind of relentless schedule.
The role ultimately went to Jack Lord,
who was also incredibly passionate about making Hawaii his permanent home and the base for the production.
And as we love those biographical loops, here's a beautiful piece of trivia. Jack Lord, the man who eventually took the McGarrett role, had actually appeared with Richard Boone in the very first episode of Have Gun Will Travel.
Three bells to Perdido. It's a small, deeply connected world. The legacy here is that Boone, though not starring, profoundly impacted the structure of television production for decades. He became an industry mover and shaker.
And while he was fighting for a Hawaii Five-0 to be shot locally, he was also developing his own island-based project.
He shot a pilot, Kona Coast, in 1968, which he co-produced. He was deeply invested in proving that local Hawaiian production could sustain a series. But ultimately, CBS chose the more structured crime drama of Hawaii Five-0, and Kona Coast was later released theatrically.
Despite the Hawaiian interlude, Boone's talent for complex, often menacing roles didn't go unnoticed on the mainland. He kept returning for significant film work.
Oh, he was highly sought after, often playing villains or complex characters who were capable of great cruelty but also had intelligence. He was in The Warlord with Charlton Heston, But arguably one of his most memorable late career performances was as the utterly ruthless outlaw Grimes in the fantastic 1967 Paul Newman Western, Hombre.
Grimes is a classic example of Boone leveraging his gravitas. He doesn't just play a brute, he plays a calculating, chilling villain whose menace comes from his cold logic.
He also worked with Marlon Brando on the night of the following day and reunited with his old mentor, Elia Kazan, for the arrangement in 1969. And of course, cementing his Western credentials, he supported his friend John Wayne a second time in Big Jake in 1971.
But the lure of starring on television wasn't entirely gone, especially when it involved innovation. In the early 70s, he returned to TV, once again partnering with his friend Jack Webb,
who produced his next and final major series, Heck Ramsey.
Heck Ramsey ran as part of the NBC mystery movie rotation from 1972 to 1974. The concept was explicitly designed to be another thinking man's Western, a natural evolution from Paladin.
It focused on a turn-of-the-20th century Western police detective who prioritized criminal forensic skills and brain power over his gun.
This is truly a precursor to modern crime dramas, placing scientific deduction in the context of the rugged West. What kind of forensic elements did the show focus on?
The show frequently featured Ramsey using early forensic techniques like fingerprint analysis, ballistic identification, careful crime scene examination, all methods just emerging at the turn of the century.
So while Ramsey was a skilled shooter, the drama revolved around him using his mind, not just firepower.
It positioned the brain as the ultimate weapon in the West, continuing the themes of Paladin.
And Boone himself summarized the character's connection to his past work with a wonderfully self-aware quote to an interviewer in 1972.
He did. He said, "You know, Heck Ramsey is a lot like Paladin, only fatter."
That quote is fantastic. It's a form of meta-commentary. Boone fully understood the archetype he helped create and was continually looking for ways to intellectualize it and move it forward.
He's acknowledging the passage of time, the action star embracing the role of the seasoned detective.
And his influence wasn't just confined to the U.S. television landscape. The sources indicate he made a significant international contribution, particularly to Israeli cinema, which is a truly unexpected pivot.
This is a remarkable testament to his commitment to the craft globally. He starred in Madran in 1970, which is cited as the first Israeli-produced film shot outside Israel.
It was a Western, proving his universal appeal.
But his involvement went far beyond just acting. He became an industry consultant, didn't he?
Yes. In 1970, Boone accepted a formal invitation from Israel's Commerce Ministry, specifically to provide the nascent Israeli film industry with Hollywood know-how.
So he went there to share his extensive experience in production, direction, and technical execution, helping them build a sustainable professional infrastructure.
Think of that trajectory. From combat veteran and method actor to TV star, and finally a global industry consultant and cultural exchange expert. It's an almost unbelievably broad resume.
And his contributions were clearly valued. They weren't just symbolic. His commitment to sharing that knowledge was officially recognized in 1979 when he received an award from Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin for his contributions to Israeli cinema.
It reinforces the theme that Richard Boone was much more than an actor. He was an advocate for the structure and craft of filmmaking.
Exactly.
Let's move to section 5, covering his final performances, his definitive turn to teaching, and his Florida life. After years in Hawaii and a return to U.S.-based television, Boone eventually relocated from the Pacific Coast to the Atlantic Coast, settling in St. Augustine, Florida, around 1970.
Before we delve into his life as a Floridian, we should note the powerful bookends to his film career. He completed a third film supporting John Wayne, appearing as Mike Sweeney in Wayne's final film, The Shootist, in 1976.
Being present for the final major screen performance of a fellow Western legend is a fitting, poignant moment for Boone's own career.
And for anyone who loves fantasy literature, Boone provided one of his most distinctive final performances, leveraging that famous commanding voice that first got him noticed by Lewis Milestone.
That voice became the voice of the fearsome dragon Smaug in the 1977 animated film version of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit.
If you listen back to that powerful, menacing, and intelligent vocal delivery, you immediately hear the contained intensity of Paladin, but repurposed for high fantasy. An excellent use of his singular vocal instrument.
His final film role was in The Bushido Blade in 1979, where he played Commodore Matthew C. Perry. The diversity of these final roles, Western icon, animated dragon, historical naval figure, shows he remained committed to variety until the very end.
But perhaps his most important late career activity was his definitive return to his professional roots. teaching, and education. In the mid-1970s, he returned to the neighborhood playhouse in New York City.
Not just any school, but the very institution where he had once studied acting under the GI Bill. This is a profound moment of closing the loop.
It's the methodical actor who achieved massive fame returning to the classroom to pass on that methodical training. He wasn't simply performing for the cameras anymore. He was actively preserving and sharing the craft that had defined his success.
That shift from star to mentor is a significant part of his legacy. It shows he prioritized the process of acting over the results of fame.
Right. And concurrently, in his adopted home of San Augustine, Florida, he became deeply involved in local civic life, adopting a completely new persona as a writer and local educator.
Imagine this, the iconic, sophisticated paladin living in your town and contributing to your local paper. He wrote a column called It Seems to Me for a local publication, The Town and Traveler.
It shows his deep desire to engage intellectually with his surroundings and his community, far away from the gossip and glitz of Hollywood.
And he also leveraged his professional expertise for the benefit of the local college.
Exactly. He gave acting lectures at Flagler College in St. Augustine in 1972 and 1973, bringing the gravitas and experience of the Actor's Studio and Broadway to a small Florida college. This wasn't about status, it was about genuine cultural contribution.
He also committed himself deeply to local culture, working with the annual historical production of Cross and Sword in St. Augustine, remaining involved until shortly before his death.
And this level of local engagement culminated in official state recognition in his final year. In the last year of his life, Richard Boone was appointed Florida's cultural ambassador.
It truly encapsulates his trajectory. LA kid, WWII combat soldier, New York stage actor, Hollywood star, Hawaiian television advocate, and finally Florida's designated cultural representative.
His resume spans the length and breadth of the American experience, both creatively and geographically.
Briefly, regarding his personal life, he was married three times. Jane Hopper, Mimi Kelly, and then the lasting relationship with Claire McAloon from 1951 until his death in 1981.
And his son, with Claire, Peter Boone, also became part of the family business, notably appearing as a child actor in several episodes of Half Gun Will Travel.
Keeping the family connected to the source of his iconic fame.
Yeah.
Richard Boone died on January 10th, 1981, at his home in St. Augustine, Florida, at the relatively young age of 63, due to complications from throat cancer.
And the final poignant detail of his life is one last geographical paradox that underscores his restless spirit. A man who died in Florida, having loved it enough to serve as its cultural ambassador, yet his ashes were scattered in the Pacific Ocean off Hawaii.
He remained spiritually connected to all the disparate places and experiences that shaped his extraordinary, contradictory life.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, let's synthesize these key takeaways. When you boil it all down, what does this all mean for the listener who wants to gain knowledge quickly but thoroughly?
The core takeaway is the profound power of preparation and contradiction that defined Richard Boone's career. He was the methodical, educated, trained actor, a product of the Actor's Studio, who, because of that very deep training, became synonymous with the rugged authenticity of the American West.
His success proves that profound theatrical training can lead to the most enduring and believable portrayal of complexity, even when that character appears simple on the surface.
And he leveraged his real-world experience, from the oil rigs to the tail gunner seat, to ground his sophisticated theatrical technique.
And his influence was far more pervasive than just his acting roles. He actively shaped the cultural and economic infrastructure of television.
His time in Hawaii was not just a retreat. It was a period of passionate advocacy that directly resulted in the creation of a major, successful, sustained television production hub there, fundamentally changing the industry's geography.
Boone's story is a compelling case study on the value of versatility. His background ensured that whether he was delivering medical diagnoses on Medic, quoting Shakespeare on Broadway, embodying the intellectual gunfighter Paladin, or solving a crime with forensics as Heck Ramsey, he brought a deep, lived understanding of human character.
He ensured his performances always landed with credibility because he understood the extremes of human experience, from the intensity of combat to the formality of classical stage work.
He never allowed himself to be contained by the expectation of a single role or a single coast. He was an LA native with New York roots who became a Hawaiian advocate and a Florida cultural fixture.
And we finish with one final provocative thought for you to consider as you reflect on his legacy. The man who was Paladin, the ultimate gun for hire, the action star, was ultimately most fulfilled in his final decade as an educator and a civic advocate.
He returned to teaching at the neighborhood playhouse where he had once been a student, seeking to pass on the method.
Exactly. Consider the significance of the world-weary action star concluding his career by returning to the classroom to train the next generation of actors at the very place he started. It suggests that for Richard Boone, the highest form of performance was not fame, but the transmission of knowledge and the mentoring of new talent, thereby securing his legacy not just as a star, but as a defining figure in the craft of acting itself.
That's a powerful conclusion, suggesting his greatest passion was truly for the art of transformation, not just the limelight. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the unexpectedly cultured, well-traveled, and highly influential life of Richard Boone. We'll see you next time.